Genesis chapter 18. This chapter is divided cleanly into two halves. The first half, verses 1 to 15, are where the angels are sent by God to meet Abraham to announce the birth of Isaac within the year. Wonderful news. And then verses 16 to 33, the angels announced Abraham that they are descending to Sodom to deceive it really is as sinful as it sounds down there, and then to bring destruction to it. Now, it seems odd that the chapter would divide it in these two halves, announcing life and then announcing death and destruction. But it shouldn't surprise us, because Isaac in the scriptures, as we'll see, is a clear picture of Messiah. He's a clear picture of Messiah. And when Messiah, the announcement of Messiah, comes into the world, death and destruction come into the world as well. Because you see, when the light comes into the world, the darkness is destroyed. And we know that before Messiah establishes his kingdom on earth, he's going to do some ground clearing, some site clearing. And he's going to be removing those things from the earth that are antagonistic to his kingdom. And he comes with a sword, and before he brings peace. Yeshua brings peace not through compromise, but through victory. And so we see these two announcements by the same angels laid side by side in this chapter. Now, the name of this Torah portion that begins in chapter 18 is called Vayera, because the verse starts out, chapter 18, verse 1, Vayera Eloi Adonai be'Elone Mamre, and Adonai appeared to him in the plains of Mamre. And Vayera means, and he appeared. But we encounter this exact same word in the previous chapter. Back in chapter 17, verse 1, it says, Now when Abram was 99 years old, Adonai Vayera appeared to Abram and said to him, I am El Shaddai, walk before me and be blameless. Now, what did God look like when he appeared to Abram back in the previous chapter? We don't know. It doesn't say. It says he appeared to him, so it wasn't just a voice. There was something that was seen. Maybe it was just a vision, maybe it was a dream, maybe it was just a light that filled the tent. We don't know. There is no detail given whatsoever. But here in chapter 18, when God appears, what does Abraham see? Adonai appeared to him in the plains of Mamre while he was sitting in... By the way, the word Mamre comes from a word that means to see, the plains of vision, or however you want to translate it. At the entrance of the tent, the heat of the day, he lifted his eyes and saw, and behold, three men. Three men were standing or stationed over him. God appears to him as three men. Now, as you go through this, especially in the Hebrew, sometimes these three men are referred to as they, or you in the plural, sometimes as he, singular, or you, singular. They're called Adonai, Yateh Vaveh, but then a little bit later on, they're called angels. What's going on here? You know, our Greek minds want to ask, what is it? Are they angels, or is this God? Is this the Trinity, or is one of the three God, the other two are angels? Why are they called men? I mean, we get all mixed up and all confused, and we shouldn't, because it's really not that complicated. Here's a good way to understand angels and how they work. The word angelos in Greek or malak in Hebrew means a messenger. Messengers, that's all it means. Sometimes messengers are human beings. Sometimes God's the messenger. Sometimes these angelic beings are the messengers. You have to look at the context to understand what is speaking or who is speaking. And a messenger is just that. The message and the messenger are one. Now, here's how you can understand this. Let's say I have my cell phone here, and it rings, and it's, I don't know, it's Joe Ramuni back there. Joe, can I pick on you? Joe calls me. So I pick up my phone, hello? And I say, well, hi, Joe, how are you? Now, what am I talking to? A plastic box. Could you imagine some aliens coming down and looking through the windows and says, a plastic box called Joe by Earthling, you know? And they think this plastic box is called Joe, because I'm calling this thing Joe. How are you, Joe? What's happening? You know, and we're talking, conversing. All they see is me, a living creature, talking to a plastic box in my hand called Joe. But am I talking to the plastic box, or am I talking through the plastic box to someone who is unseen? You understand? Now, let's say this phone has a mind of its own. It can think. It's a smartphone. Would it behave any differently? No. I'd be speaking through it to the one I cannot see on the other side. And when I hear Joe talk, guess what? It's not Joe I hear, really. It's a vibration inside the little speaker up there by my ear. But for all practical purposes, it's Joe, because when Joe speaks, this thing perfectly enunciates what he says. Maybe he's hundreds and thousands of miles away. That little black box, that's how an angel works. This is why so many times when a human being encounters the angel is called Adonai. Just like when I'm talking to the phone, I'm saying, "Hi, Joe." You understand? So here's my question for you. Why is it in chapter 17 when God, Vayera, he appeared to Abram? We don't have any details. But here in this chapter, Abraham has distinct details. He sees three human, look like human beings. He called three men. He talks with them individually. He feeds them. He walks with them. He converses with them. He even pleads with them. Why is it so different from chapter 17? What has happened between God appearing to Abram in 17 and God appearing to him here in 18? What has happened? Yes, circumcision. And if you missed the teaching on circumcision, please go back and listen to that, because it's so foundational to understanding so much of what takes place in the Word of God. But that circumcision is always a picture of taking the flesh, especially the flesh of the heart, the flesh of the ears, setting it aside and connecting with God without fleshliness in the way. And so when Abram sees God, when God appears to him, now it's with a distinct detail. One of the reasons we do not connect with God as well as we can is because the flesh is in the way. The flesh is in the way. We have fleshly appetites. So many times we go to pray. Sometimes our praise of God is nothing more than bribery or flattery. You know how flattery will get you everywhere? I'll tell you something, flattery will get you nowhere with God. There's a distinct difference between flattering God and praising Him. When I praise someone, they are in view. When I flatter someone, it's all about me. You understand? And I hope I never flatter people. I hope if I give you praise, you understand it's genuine praise. But instead of requesting things from God, we whine to Him. And so much of our prayer is very fleshly in its nature. If we can just get the flesh out of the way, if we can get our pursuit of God out of the way, instead of pursuing Him for our sakes, pursue Him for His own sake, because He desires for us to pursue Him, to search for Him, and to find Him. And we make it about Him, the flesh begins to go away, and He becomes more distinct, more in focus. So, let's begin. Let's read through the first eight verses. Verse 2, he lifted his eyes and saw, and behold, three men were stationed over him. He perceived. Now, this is the third time we've seen the form of the word see. God appeared in verse 1. Verse 2, he lifted his eyes and saw. And then later in verse 2, he perceived. So he ran toward them from the entrance of the tent and bowed. Now, that word bow there is the word worship. That you have to understand the word worship, chava in Hebrew, Doesn't mean raising your hands and singing and jumping and dancing. That's called praise. The word worship in Hebrew means you go from vertical to horizontal on your face, not on your back, on your face. That act of making yourself small, of just putting the flesh out of the way, that is the word that is translated worship. That is worship. In other words, in worship, you don't do anything. And I know I've gone over this many times, and if you heard it and you're bored with it, you can just check the scores on your smartphones or something. I'll get back with you. But praise and worship are not the same thing. Praise is physical. Worship is spiritual. And John, Yeshua meets the woman at the well, and they have a conversation. And in the conversation, Yeshua says to her, God is spirit, and he seeks those who will worship him in spirit and in truth. Praise can involve singing, standing, hand raising, dancing, clapping, all those physical expressions. It's an expression, but worship itself is utterly, completely, and totally spiritual. There's no flesh involved. It is silent. It is still. It is internal. And it can be extremely boring. Praise is a lot of fun. But so much for what passes for praise and worship, there's no worship at all. Now, there's no such thing as a worship team. Praise teams, yes. Worship teams, no. Unless they're all laying on their faces on the stage and getting you to do the same. And they're not saying anything. They're enforcing the silence. Then maybe there's a worship team, but I haven't seen one of those yet. Worship is utterly spiritual. God works from the inside out. We start with worship. And this is why the liturgical prayer service is so important. Yes, we're reading aloud, but we're basically by ourselves all together at the same time, just quietly, just focusing on truth. And then we'll do some singing, which is a form of praise. But too many times what can happen is we start with a praise, which becomes cheerleading, hoping that we get people excited enough, then they'll feel God's presence or something like that. It can be manipulative. Now, I'm not condemning praise. I'm not condemning praise teams. I'm just saying let's make sure there is worship involved somewhere along the line. And it's best if it precedes the praise. But the word chava simply means to go prostrate, to bow down, to go horizontal, to make yourself small and be still, to be quiet. Submit yourself. And if you do that, you know what? It won't be long before you want to start praising God. If you truly worship, praise will follow. Okay, we need a microphone over here for Priscilla. And if you're visiting, you're welcome to ask questions and share comments. So Priscilla, thank you for starting us off. Okay, go right ahead.
Does worship have to be on your face or can you be on your knees?
It can be hanging upside down in a well. It doesn't. It just basically means it's. I say that because I heard a guy share. In fact, there's a poem about a bunch of guys discussing what's the best way to pray. Should you kneel? Should you stand? Should you close your eyes? And he says the most effective prayer he prayed was hanging upside down on a rope in the well. And so the body position doesn't really matter. But I do find for myself, if I kneel, I somehow bringing my body into submission to that attitude of worship helps me to worship. But you can be driving a car, pushing a shopping cart, and you can truly be worshiping. But worship is very internal, very quiet, very still. Yeah. Okay, I'm glad you asked that question. All right, let's move on here. Verse 3, and he said, my master, if I find favor in your, and the word you're there is singular. Isn't that interesting? He's talking to three guys, but he uses a singular form of the word your in Hebrew. In your eyes, please pass not away from your servant. Let some water be brought and wash your feet. Now there, your is plural. Your feet, it's plural in the Hebrew. And recline beneath the tree. I will fetch a morsel of bread that you, plural, may sustain yourselves. Then go on, inasmuch as you, and that's plural, have passed your servant's way. They said, do so, just as you have said. So Abraham hastened to the tent to Sarah and said, hurry, 3 seahs of meal, fine flour, knead, and make cakes. Then Abraham ran to the cattle, took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the youth who hurried to prepare it. He took cream and milk and the calf which he had prepared and placed these before them. He stood over them beneath a tree and they ate. Now, why all this detail? You know, in Judaism, when they want to discuss hospitality, these are the 8 verses they go to. Because they say these 8 verses give us such a glimpse into Abraham's heart, and he was a man of hospitality. And he'd have his tent there at the plains where people would always be passing by. He'd have the tent flaps up, and he would sit in the doorway waiting for somebody to come down the road so he could invite them in to eat with them and to rest, and so he could minister to them. This was the nature of this man. And hospitality is such an enormous thing. It's so foundational for anyone who calls themselves a believer. Hebrews 13:1-2 says, let love of the brethren continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. For by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. You see, I think it was only later when the angels begin to prophesy to Abraham in the next verse, verse 9, that he began to realize, whoa, wait a minute. These aren't just 3 wanderers coming down the road. I want to give you some lessons in hospitality. Not that most of you need them, but maybe I should call these observations in hospitality. Robin is such a wonderful example to me of hospitality, and this is a skill that over our 37 years of marriage that she's really developed, and I'm amazed at her spirit of hospitality to people. And we talked about this some last night, so a lot of these pointers come from her, but we kind of work together. First of all, don't make it about you. Make it about others. Don't invite people into your home to show off your house, to show off your stuff, to show off your cooking, to show off this. Make it as a service to them. Make it about them. Too many times when you make hospitality about you, you won't be hospitable. When you make it about others, you can't help but be hospitable and to invite them into your home. And your home is not for separation. I should say it's not for separation only. One of the purposes of a house is to separate you from the world, to give you a place of quiet and calm, a place of calm in the storm. But it is also a place for connection. And if you do not use your home as a place of connection with others, you may lose your home. I have found people with small houses who practice hospitality, and somehow God increased their space. And I have found people of big houses who did not practice hospitality, and they lost their big houses. Hospitality is not an option for the believer. It's foundational. I've noticed, over the decades of knowing many different ministers and people who were in the ministry, I've noticed that the ones who did not practice hospitality, their ministry shrunk up, faded, and disappeared. But the ones who practice genuine, But the ones who practice genuine hospitality, their ministries would flourish. God, after all, has invited us into his house. That's an example. We should invite others into ours. And by the way, folks, it's not about entertaining. Oh, you might have some entertainment. It's about connecting. It's about serving. It's about really reinforcing friendships and brotherly love. That's what it's about. Not impressing, not entertaining. And one of the things you'll find is that guests in your home will infuse the home with additional layers of memories and meaning. I always tell people when they move into a new house or new apartment, You know, it feels so new and kind of odd and different and fun and wonderful. But I tell them, it'll take about a year as you go through the holy days, have Sabbaths and Erev Shabbats in your home, have people over, then memories begin to pile up in that home. It's like the value of that home grows and grows and grows. And and there, each house, I find, has a spirit about it, a certain something you can't quite put your finger on. But places of hospitality have a certain warmth. The moment you step through the door, you can sense it. In places that don't practice hospitality, there's a coldness. There's a coldness about it. It's like they have the welcome mat on the inside of the door. So you see welcome when you go out. Like, okay, you're welcome to leave, right? But we always have excuses. And please take these with a grain of salt. Because there are some reasons sometimes you simply can't have people over. I get it, all right? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the excuses you make that are just excuses. My home is too tiny. No, it's not. If it is real tiny, invite tiny people. or small groups of people, just one or two others, just a couple other people over. You don't want to have, but there's room for a couple more people there. All right, there is. I mean, Abraham didn't even have a house. He had a tent. And he didn't invite him inside. They said, sit under the tree. It's probably cooler. It says, just, I mean, he didn't stop him from practicing hospitality. I don't know how to cook. There's a pizza shop somewhere nearby. You can order pizza. Now, if you're like me, when I was single, I would call up somebody and say, hey, you guys want to come over for pizza on Saturday night? And they'd say, sure, what should we bring? I'd say, pizza. And but, you know, it's like, it's okay. You know, take something you do want to make. It doesn't make, have coffee, for Pete's sake. Buy some cookies or something at the store. But it's about the people. It's not about you and all the extravagance. Some people say, well, no one ever invites me to their house. And I didn't mean to put boo-hoo there. That should have actually been a reference to 1 Peter 4:9, which says, be hospitable to one another without complaint. Make sure you're hospitable, you're not selling your hospitality. In other words, I'll invite the Remarks over to my house, but I better get an invitation to theirs. Well, see, you're selling hospitality then. I did this for you, and I expect you to do this for me. Now we're even, Stephen. But you know what? If you invite someone to your home, and they come, and you have a good time, and they never invite you to theirs, then you should be rejoicing, because that means your reward's going to come from God instead. It's going to be much better. It's going to be eternal. Don't look for payback. Abraham saw these three guys walking down the road, and he knew there was zero chance they would ever invite him into their house, because obviously they didn't have one. They're wandering down the road, or they live far, far away. He'll never be in their house. Did that stop him from inviting them to stop, to rest, and to feed them, and to bring them something to drink and eat, and just to minister to them? No, he wasn't looking for anything in return. It was all giving, giving, giving to them. Yes, Carla, let's get a microphone to Carla.
Isn't the tradition that he was still very sore too? He wasn't even 100%.
That I'm bringing up to the next one where it says I'm too unhealthy. Some people say my health prevents me. Now, this may be legitimate. I mean, if you're bedridden, it's going to be kind of tough. But according to tradition, thank you, Carla, according to tradition, Abraham had just gotten circumcised 3 days earlier. And apparently the third day after you're circumcised, especially as an adult, is the worst. I mean, you're so sore and so painful, and you can hardly move. And yet it says he's running. He's running. He put their comfort far above his own. I can't afford it. Let me tell you something. You can't afford not to. You cannot afford not to. If you don't have time, then you're wasting your life doing something you shouldn't be wasting your life doing. Because you don't have time to practice hospitality, then you're not doing what God wants you to do. You're wasting your life on stuff that doesn't matter. You must make time to practice hospitality to others. It's one of the reasons you're on this earth. Make your home a meeting place for others to come. It doesn't have to be every day or every week. But you know, once a month, open your house up and invite a couple people over. And spend time having real conversations. Yes, a microphone over to Mim here.
I was reminded when you were speaking about the several in scriptures that talks about older women teach younger women, to go to
yes.
home, to show hospitality. Apostle Paul talked about how he shares his life
yes.
in hospitality. And I think in my own personal life, hospitality, God used it to cure a lot of selfishness in me.
Yes.
I remember when I had a baby. And we have, a lot of us women know the baby blue.
They call the baby blues, blue. Yes.
And looking out, opening up my homes, and even feeling that, we don't live by fear, we live by faith.
Yes.
In God. So opening up your homes when you don't feel like it, actually God is now blessing you.
Yes.
And causing us to begin to count our blessings.
Right, absolutely.
Just put our mind right where it's supposed to be, yes. where it's supposed to be.
Good point. Absolutely great point. When I think of the experiences I've had as a believer since I was a young man, the most profound experiences I had as a believer with other people did not happen inside a church building. They happened inside homes. One of the things, too, is that, here at Beth Dacoon, let me explain something to you. We don't do programs. We'll occasionally have a function, like we'll be having a Purim party, and well, once in a while, a few times a year, we'll have the lamb roast over at Dan and Valerie's. But we don't do a lot of functions, a lot of church activities, so to speak. Because, you see, we don't want you waiting around thinking, oh, I'm bored, when are they going to have something? I want something to go do. No. We'd rather you practice hospitality. You bored? Want to get together some people? You own a phone? Right? Call them up and invite them over. Invite them over. Exercise hospitality in your homes. That's what we want people to practice. That is where it's really at. And I'm so thrilled every time I hear that, I had so-and-so over to my house, or I was invited. I love it when I hear you're all meeting with one another. I'd much rather you do that than ever invite me over. Not that I don't want to come, but I'd just rather you invite one another, invite me. I love it that when you're showing hospitality to one another, nothing thrills my soul more than that. That is where it should be. Not waiting for the church or for Beth Dacoon to say, okay, we're going to have a covered dish dinner, we're going to have this function, and so come. I mean, those are things that are okay, but those can be artificial. But when you call someone you want to have in your home, there's nothing artificial about that. It's genuine. You want to connect with these people. Robin, she's a shy person, and a lot of times when she would invite somebody over, an hour or so before they come. She's thinking, is the house clean enough? Is the food going to be good enough? Is there going to be enough food? Is Grant going to behave himself? And she over the last few years, she's developed this habit. When she starts to feel that way a little bit before company comes, she'll stop and she'll begin to pray for the individuals by name that are going to be coming to the house, praying that they sense hospitality, that there'll be real connection, that God will guide the conversations, that they'll be blessed. And when the evening's over and they go back home, they'll be blessed. And she says when she does that, that when that doorbell rings, she is so thrilled to see them. She just is so thrilled. There's a gush of love she feels for the people who walk through the door, because she's been praying for them and she's looking forward to serving them. And that's just pure joy when you do that. And You know, if you have an apartment or any, you all have a roof over your head, that's one of your greatest assets that God has given you. Where you live, your domicile. That is one of your greatest tools and assets. Use it for His kingdom. Use it for His kingdom. This is one of the reasons we cancel services here several times a year. So you don't begin to think that this building is the focal point of Beth Tikkun. No, God is the focal point of Beth Tikkun, and you are. Practice the Sabbath, observe Sabbath in your homes. So I want you to understand, if something happened, we couldn't meet here anymore, Beth Tikkun would go on without missing a beat, because our home is the center. That is the real temple, that where we minister to one another and meet with God. Hospitality is the foundation of all ministry, and be a child of Abraham. Abraham practiced hospitality, and he knew how to do it right. We have a lot to learn from this man, our spiritual father. Yes, Adam. Let's get a microphone to Adam over here. Yes.
One of the obstacles sometimes can be the vulnerability of inviting somebody into your home. And I know we've had multiple times, you know, we have somebody over and we're like, well, I want to do whatever, I don't have to do the prayers, I don't have to do this and do that. So some real practical suggestion for anybody that wants to host but is insecure about it is I'm under Haynes in the directory, just call me up and we'll take
Yeah, well, we're all, there's a lot of volunteers come to your house and help you do Erev Shabbat. Yeah, it's a ministry we have. We will come and even eat your food and help you with the prayers. We will be starting our discipleship programs very shortly, hopefully next month in March. And one of the things we want to do as part of the discipleship is to have the classes move from home to home of the people in each group. And then to meet on a Friday night, and so each home can host an Erev Shabbat and makes it part of the learning, you know, and just, it's, I don't know why people get all threatened by it, honestly, because there's no wrong way to do it. The only wrong way to do it is to not do it at all. But, so that's something we're looking forward to helping people with, if that's a challenge for you. Well, let's move on a bit more. Let's go on to verse 9. They said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And he said, "Behold, in the tent." And he said, "I will surely..." Notice how it keeps going from plural to singular, plural to singular. It's really kind of odd. "I will surely return to you at this time next year, and behold, Sarah, your wife, will have a son." Now Sarah was listening at the entrance of the tent, which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well on in years. The manner of women had ceased to be with Sarah. She is long past menopause, in other words. And Sarah laughed within herself. Now, if yours says at herself, that's not correct. She laughed within herself, saying, "After I have withered, shall I again have pleasure? And my husband is old?" Then Adonai said to Abraham, "Why is it that Sarah laughs, saying, 'Shall I in truth bear a child, though I have aged? Is anything beyond Adonai? At the appointed time, I will return to you at this time next year, and Sarah will have a son.' Sarah denied it, saying, 'I did not laugh,' for she was frightened. But he said, 'No, you laughed indeed.'" So Sarah laughs, and she gets corrected for it. But go back to chapter 17 for a moment. And I sent out an email and asked you to look at this. Back in chapter 17, Abraham is told that he will have a son. And look what he does. Verse 17, chapter 17, verse 17. "Abraham threw himself upon his face and laughed and thought, 'Shall a child be born to a 100-year-old man? And shall Sarah, a 90-year-old woman, give birth?' And Abraham said to God, 'Oh, that Ishmael might live before you.'" In other words, he believed he's going to have another son, but that puts Ishmael in a tough spot. He laughed so hard, he was laughing out LOL, literally. No, what was it? ROGLOL, rolling on the ground, laughing out loud? But something like that. But he was rolling on the ground. He was laughing so hard. Did he get rebuked? Not a bit. So Sarah has a little giggle inside. She gets rebuked. Abraham's rolling on the ground laughing. It's all good. What do you think's going on here? Why does Abraham get away at laughing about God's promise and Sarah doesn't? Yes, let's get a microphone to Rick right here. Or is just a quick answer? Just
Sarah denied it. It says she denied
it. Well, why did she deny it? Why would? Because she was in trouble. She knew she was caught. But why?
Yeah, but she denied it. That's the difference in the two, in my opinion.
Okay, she denied it. All right, Deborah says because she didn't have the faith of Abraham. And that's very close to what the sages say. They say the problem with Sarah is not that she laughed. She didn't laugh enough. Okay? Sharon, let's get a microphone to Sharon. Go ahead. Let's get one over to her.
Well, you stole my thunder.
Oh, sorry about that.
Yes, when I thought about this after your email, I thought quite a bit about it. And I agree with you. I had the vision of him just literally falling to the floor with just an outburst of laughter. It's almost like,
yes,
becomes the name of the promise.
Right.
So to me, it was like Hashem would say, you go for it, buddy. I'm really
exactly.
This.
Yes, very good. Thank you. Yeah, the son, Isaac, Yitzchak, means laughter. So I put it this on a chart. I have Abraham on the left, and this is chapter 17, verse 17, and then Sarah on the right from our chapter 18. And it says of Abraham, he threw himself on his face and laughed. But Sarah laughed within herself. She was hiding the laughter. Now there's the key. Why was she hiding the fact she's laughing? Because she knew that her kind of laughter was very different from Abraham's. You know, there are two kinds of laughter. There's a laughter that comes from delight in the outcome. And there's a laughter like with Sarah's that comes from doubt in the process. Because you notice what she says, after I become worn out, shall I again have pleasure? In other words, how's this going to happen? And my husband is old, how can he father a child? He's 100 years old. How's that going to happen? Abraham completely overlooked the process of how a woman who went through menopause decades earlier, and now him 100 years old, and how out of their union is going to come a baby. He didn't worry about the process. He looked at the end product. I'm going to have a son. Sarah's going to have a baby. He just jumped right over the process to the end product. He latched on to what was set ahead, what the goal. And now his question, shall a child be born to a 100-year-old man? He didn't ask how a 100-year-old man could father a child. Shall a child be born to a 100-year-old man? That's amazing. Shall Sarah, an 8-year-old woman, give birth? Incredible. He doesn't ask how. And also, their questions are in different order. His first question is, shall a child be born to a 100-year-old man? Sarah's second question is, and my husband is old? Abraham's second question is, and shall Sarah, a 90-year-old woman, give birth? And Sarah's first question is, after I have become worn out, shall I have pleasure? She's all focused on this can't happen. This is not logical. Doesn't compute. He jumps right to the fact he sees her holding a son. He sees him a father of a son. And how it gets there, I'm not worried about it. You know, maybe this is more of a male trait, female trait. I'm not sure. You think? You ladies tell me. Is this more, all right? No, she would say no. But I do know that men, I mean, even little boys, what do you want to be when you grow up? An astronaut, a professional football player. I want to be they have all these things they want to be. How are you going to become one? I don't know. But a woman, the power of the feminine is to take a thought from the man, a dream of the man, a sperm from the man, and to take it into her body, into her life, into her soul, and make the process happen. This is the power of a wife. And she doesn't just do this when she's making babies. She does this when she takes the man's dreams and helps refine it down to one thing that he's called to do, and helps him to realize the thing he's called to do, then helps him bring that idea, that seed thought, into reality. That's how a marriage is supposed to work. That's the power of the feminine soul. And don't ever doubt how powerful a woman's soul is. The problem with women is they take that power and they give it to something else instead of the real things God has called them to give it to. It's powerful. Don't misuse the power that you ladies have. Use it for the eternal. Okay? And there's a hand back here, so let's give a microphone to Lydia. There it comes, dropping out of the sky for you. Okay?
Is there something else? Like, when God was talking to Abraham directly?
Yes.
When it seems like Sarah is overhearing it. Like, he's not even talking directly to Sarah.
No, she's behind the tent flap, listening.
So is there something to that? I don't know. It just seems like she's overhearing it.
Yeah.
When God told him, he was actually talking to Abraham about Sarah. I don't know, it just seems like there's...
Yeah, there is something to that. Abraham's outside, Sarah's in the tent. There's a very spiritual meaning to that. And a woman's power is like a circle. There's this wonderful book called Circle, Arrow, Spiral, written by a Jewish lady. I know some of the ladies here went to hear her speak. I can't remember the name, but she was up in Cleveland. Circle, Arrow, Spiral. And she says, women are like the circle. It's secure, it's here. And they are to dwell within the circle, because their gift from God is to be. But men are like an arrow. Their gift from God is to do. And what happens, you take the circle and the arrow and combine them? They become a spiral, moving upward. The arrow and the circle combine. You understand? So the power of the woman and the power of the man combined, and she moves upward while he remains in the circle. You understand? And it's a powerful image she has, and it's a wonderful book. Circle, Arrow, Spiral. I encourage all of you to read it. Just a great, great book. Well, let's move on. We have some other important things to get to. So anyways, they go through this. And by the way, I'm not going to read it, but Romans 4, 18 to 21 describes the faith Abraham had when he received the promise that Sarah would be having a child. A wonderful passage, but we're just going to move on for right now. Now, it says in the scripture she denied it. When the angel said, oh, she laughed. She said, I didn't laugh. She denied it. You know that word for denied, the word kakash, is the word to lie? The word to deny and the word to lie are the same word in Hebrew. She lied. That's what you should put there. She lied and said, oh, I didn't laugh. Now, did she purposely lie? Did she think she was lying? No. It's just that her definition of laughter was different from God's. In her mind, it wasn't a laugh at all. But in God's mind, it was laughter. It was the wrong kind. You know, just like there can be the right kind of laughter and the wrong kind of laughter, you could have the right kind of questions, the wrong kinds of questions. Some people ask questions to raise doubts. This is what Satan was a master of. Did God really say that you couldn't eat of this tree? You know? He wasn't asking a question to get information. He was asking a question to stir up doubt. And I've heard people say, I'm just asking questions. I said, yeah, and they're dangerous ones, because they're there to stir up doubt, not get information, not to seek truth. Good answers seek truth. Good questions help inspire us to dig deeper. They inspire us to search more, and they open up doors to learning. There's also good answers and bad answers. You know, two people can give the same answer to the same question, but one answer is good, one answer is bad. The motive of one person giving the answer can be to minister to the person who asked and to help them and to serve them. And the other person give the exact same answer and to show off like, I'm the answer man. And it actually breaks connection instead of making connection. Think about that. And we could go on and on and on how the same thing can be used for good or for bad, but that's a story for another time. But an example of the word kash in the Torah, Leviticus 6, 2 and 3, when a person sins and acts unfaithfully against Adonai and deceives, that's the same word as Sarah denying. And it goes on, or has found what was lost and lied about it, kash, same word as deny. I don't know why our English translations try to soften it for Sarah. She just outright lied, though I think she really didn't think what she did was a laugh. God says, yeah, it was, but it was a bad use of laughter. It's not what I gave you laughter for. You're using laughter as an expression of your doubt. Abraham is using laughter as an expression of his joy because he believes the promise I'm making. Understand? All right. Now, this next passage here is to me, it was something I'd never quite really noticed before as to how profound it is. He throws himself on the ground and laughs, and I need to get in the right chapter here. Okay, here we are. Now this is better. In verse 17, chapter 18, verse 17. Let's start with verse 16. So the men got up from there and gazed down towards Sodom, while Abraham walked with them to escort them. Now, these next couple of verses give us a rare look into God's thought processes. I'm so glad he has shared this with us because it's a very insightful and profound look into how God's mind works. Don't miss what is being taught here. Verse 17, and Adonai said, shall I conceal from Abraham what I do? Now that Abraham is surely to become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by him. So God is asking himself, should I really conceal from Abraham what I'm going to do down here in Sodom? And he decides no. Now there are a couple of good reasons why he shouldn't. First of all, Sodom and Gomorrah are part of what is going to be Abraham's inheritance. So he should be made aware of what's going to be taking place on his turf. And another thing, I think, is that roughly, they think about 52 years earlier is when Abraham rode down and rescued Lot and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah from the attacking kings who carried them away. He saved Sodom and Gomorrah 50-some years earlier. So it's only appropriate that God tells him, you know what? You saved them 50 years ago, but this time, it's time for them to go. So he thinks it's time to share with Abraham. But here's the profound part. Verse 19, for I have known him, I've known Abraham, because he will command, it doesn't say commands, but will command, to make sure it's future tense in your translations, because he will command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of Adonai, doing charity and justice, in order that Adonai might then bring upon Abraham that which he had spoken of him. There are two important things here. He's going to share information with Abraham because of what he knows Abraham will do, what he's going to accomplish. And because he knows that Abraham is going to accomplish, that's the second thing, God says, and I will bring my promises upon him. God's promises are almost always, well, half the time at least, they're conditional. They make a promise, but there's an if involved. And the if depends on us. And if we fulfill the prerequisites for the promise, God fulfills it. And if we do not, God withdraws it. But God's going to give information to Abraham because he knows what Abraham's going to do with his children. Now, Let's take that a step further. If God is not sharing information with you, could it be because he knows that you're not going to walk in his ways? You're not going to remain faithful? I want you to think about the parable that Yeshua shares. It's in Matthew 25, the parable of the talents. There's this nobleman, a wealthy man. He's going to go on a journey, so he calls his three servants in. He gives one of them 5 talents. He gives one of them 2 talents, I believe it is, and gives one of them 1 talent. And the man with 5 talents earns 5 more. The man with 2 earns 2 more, but the one with the 1 doesn't do anything with it. He just gives it back. Now think about it for a second. Why did this nobleman give the guy with 1 talent just 1 talent? Because the nobleman's a picture of God, and God knew what he would do with it, and that is nothing. Do you ever wonder maybe why you have so little insight into the Word, why you have so little information from God, why you have so small connection with him? Maybe because God knows you're not going to do anything with it. And here's an amazing thing too. If you go over to Luke 19, Yeshua shares the same parable but a slightly different version. In this version, when he comes back and has the men give an account, he tells each one that made a return on his investment, says, because you came back and you returned the 10 mina, instead of talents in this story, the 10 minas, the 10 weights of gold, I will make you ruler over 10 cities. Think about that for a second. Because you were faithful in this small thing, it's now going to be a big thing. But God knows what you're going to do with what he gives. And so when he knows you're not going to do much, he's not going to give much. Now that can sound pretty depressing if I just ended the teaching right there. But you see, there's another parable where a servant to a nobleman became terribly in debt because he wasted everything the nobleman had given him to invest. And when he realized he was in trouble, you know what he did? He repented. And he went out, he began to collect some debts, small debts. So give me just a little bit of that. Help do this and do this and do this. And he went around to these different ones, and he had a little something to give to his master when he was called before him. And the master was pleased. So you can change your destiny. Change it like that. And when you decide, I am going to be faithful with what God has given me, all of a sudden, your entire future changes. You're at a fork in the road every day of your life. You're at a fork in the road, and you choose a destiny every single day. Your destiny is not determined for you. Your destiny is in your hands. Every day, choose the right fork. I'm going to be faithful. I'm going to do the things God wants me to do. I'm going to be a wise person. I'm going to be a righteous person. I am going to consume his word. I'm going to live it out, and I'm not going to veer from the path. And you can start doing that today. When you start doing that today, all of a sudden you find this wealth of spiritual treasure pouring into your life. But God knows what you're going to do, and what he's doing now is based on what he knows you're going to do with it. So change what you're going to do with it. Don't try to figure it out, by the way. It's just how it works. It's just how it works. And in verse 19 says, for I have known him. Well, doesn't God know everybody? Yes and no. 1 Corinthians 8, verses 2 and 3. Paul says this, if anyone supposes that he knows anything, he is not yet known as he ought to know. So what do you think you know? Whatever you think you know, guess what? You don't know it the way you should. This is why I have told you before. When anyone asks me, do you know the Bible very well? I say no. And I really mean that. The more I study, the more I realize I've not even scratched the surface. It is so deep. It's as deep and wide and as eternal as God himself. How can anyone possibly say, I know the Bible? Oh, you can memorize all the words, but that doesn't mean you know it. So, if you think you know something, guess what? You don't. But it goes on. It says, but if anyone loves God, he is known by him. If you love God, this means God knows you. Now, what does that word know there mean? In Hebrew and in Greek, to know something means to be one with it. We tend to think you know something, you got some fact about something in your head. God says, no, when you know something, you're one with it. You're one with it. It impacts the way you live, the way you think, the way you act, the way you feel. It becomes one with you. This is why in Hebrew, the word for love, ahava, and the word for one, echad, have the same numerical value, 13. They have the same value, love and one, because that's what happens. And this also helps to understand Matthew 7:23, where Yeshua says, and then I will declare to them, I never knew you. You understand it? It doesn't mean I wasn't aware of you. We were never one. You never loved me. You never connected with me. We never truly became united. And he says, depart from me, you who practice Torahlessness. And that's a quote from Psalm 6:8. In this week's Torah portion, the Ten Commandments are given on Mount Sinai. And in the commandments, God happens to state that he shows loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You see, when you keep God's commandments, you're doing what God does. His commandments are a reflection of who he is and what he does and how he behaves. It's a reflection of his value system. It's a reflection of his mind. So we take his commandments and we begin to obey them and build them into our minds, the way Adam was sharing. Then that's proof that we love him. Because you want to be connected to people you love. And Yeshua says the same thing in John 14:15. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. Period. There it is. Simple. You'll love me. If you love me, you'll keep my commandments. Now, it could be you're not aware of them. But if you love God, you want to know him. It could be you misunderstand some. He understands that. But if you love him, you want to make his Torah your occupation, as David says in Psalm 119. He says, if your Torah was not my occupation, I would have perished in my suffering. Make God's word your occupation. Make it your delight. That's another way to translate that word. Make it your delight. Going along with this, and I shared a bit of this in the prayer service, Abraham begins to intercede with God. Verse 20 says, so Adonai said, because the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah has become great, and its outcry, and that word outcry is the same word as zechak, yitzchak, laughter. You find the word laughter all through chapter 17 and 18 in different forms, but it means an expression coming out. Then destruction, if not, I will know. 22, the men had turned from there and went to Sodom while God was still standing before Abraham. The year says Abraham was standing before God. We'll talk about that another time. But Abraham came forward and said, will you also stamp out or sweep away the righteous along with the wicked? What if there should be 50 righteous people in the midst of the city? Would you still stamp it out rather than spare the place for the sake of 50 righteous people within it? It would be sacrilege to you to do such a thing, to bring death upon the righteous along with the wicked. We've learned in this chapter lessons from Abraham about hospitality. Now we learn lessons from Abraham about prayer. And notice what Abraham bases all of his prayers on. Not on what he wants, although he wants the city to be spared, but based on what is suitable to God. What are God's ways? What is God's reputation going to be if he wipes out the righteous? Every appeal he makes to God is based on God's character. And if Abraham didn't know God's character, he wouldn't know how to appeal to him. We need to know the one we pray for. This is why Yeshua says in John 15 that we read in the prayer service, That if you, you know, if you abide in my word, you can ask whatever you want. Really? Anything I want? Yes, if you abide in his word. Because you see, if you abide in his word, you'll know what to want. You get it? If you abide in his word and his word abides in you, there's certain things you're not going to want anymore. You're not going to be asking for things you shouldn't. You're going to be asking things according to his will. Whatever you ask in my name, my Father will do it for you. What does that mean? That means if you ask it as if I were asking it, you would ask for the things I would ask for, he'll do it. We have to know him to be able to do that. But as you go through here, down in verse 27, Abraham responded and said, "Behold, now I desire to speak to my Lord, although I am but dust and ash," or dust and ashes. Afer v'afer. There it is in Hebrew. And you'll notice the two words, afer and afer, are almost identical. This vav here simply means and. That's how you make the word and in Hebrew. You add a vav. A hook is what it means. Vav is a hook. You add a hook to the next word, it means and. So here's dust, afer, and here's afer, ashes. The only difference between the two words is the initial letter, the aleph and the ayin here. But dust and ashes. The only other place this term appears is over in Job 42, when Job is talking to God. And I shared a little of this in the prayer service, but we'll just share it here, and then our time will be up. Afer is just dry dirt. Adama is moist soil. And Adam was made out of the Adama. It's like clay, you can pack it together, but Afer is just dry dirt soil. The wind blows, it's like a dust storm. Afer is ashes. Ashes come from something that's once alive and now has been destroyed by fire. We come from Afer, we go to Afer. We come from dust and go to dust. But here there's also been Afer, there's been fire and destruction. And Abraham says, "I'm just dust and ashes. That's all I am." Now here's a wonderful thing. If you want to grow something, you have to have dirt. And ashes make wonderful fertilizer. This is why after forest fires, you have all this carbon, all these ashes everywhere. The new trees, new plants just pop out of the ground, and it's incredible how quickly that forest replaces itself because it grows out of the ashes of the one before. All you need is moisture and a seed. And when you do that, offer this word here, offer becomes Ephraim. Ephraim, fruitful. So you might think, "I'm just dust and ashes." Good. Great starting point. Wonderful. You need some living water poured into you and embrace the seed of his word. God, just pour your spirit into me. Plant the seed of your word within me. Do with me what you will. And Afer becomes Ephraim. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that wonderful? It's all good. God takes death and turns it into life. And we're going to give Jim Anderson the last word, and then we'll close in prayer. Jim?
Is there significance in the fact that there was three messengers or three angels?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that.
And then there became just the one?
Yeah, there were three messages, so there were three messengers. One message was to tell Abraham and Sarah they're going to have a baby in a year. And then when you get to this point, there are only two messengers at this point. The job of one of these messengers is to bring destruction to Sodom and Gomorrah. And then you find one messenger by himself, and his job is to rescue Lot and his family. And after one finishes his job, he just kind of just disappears. Because the message and the messenger are the same. All right? It's kind of like a telephone only appears when you get a call, and then it disappears when the call's over. That's how the angels work. So there are three jobs to do. So there are three messengers. But God speaks through all three. That's his voice. All right? All right, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for this time. Thank you for your word. And I pray that you'll take the stumbling words and the disjointed thoughts and you'll weave them together into truth that will stay with us for the rest of our lives. Make us the people you want us to be. And Lord, I pray that we would determine every day to live a life committed to you, so you can begin to reveal yourself and pour your wisdom into us. And it will not be a bad investment, because we will make a rich return on what you invest in us. So, Lord, prune us and do with us what you want to make us fruitful for you. We ask in Yeshua's name for the sake of his kingdom. Amen.